Following the news of the world, I noticed that President Zelensky of Ukraine has canceled all international travel. The speculation that the war is going so poorly there that Russia is seriously advancing. We wonder, you know, what might happen in Europe because of that. This last Thursday, I believe it was, the newly elected leader of government in the Netherlands, in Holland, he's called the Dutch Donald Trump. Because of some of his views, and I suppose because of his slick-back blonde hair makes a difference as well. But his elections apparently startled European leaders. They anticipate a radical swing to the right in Europe, and that this represents a radical swing to the right. He is very anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and they think Europe may swing that way as well. I found the war itself starting in Ukraine, it's been 2 years ago now, February, very upsetting. Any war is. There's been a lot of publicity, more of this war perhaps than any war. I don't know where you can go on the planet these days without someone having a camera that they are using to take pictures of exactly what's going on, and then it's out there for the world to see. When the war started in Israel, I was startled by that as well. Of course, these are key areas, Europe and the Middle East, and we know prophetically that they are key. And I did what many of you did. I turned to Matthew chapter 24, Luke chapter 21, Mark chapter 13, but I did not go there to see, is this the beginning of the end? I did not go there to see, how does this fit into the overall platform or structure of end-time prophecy. I went there for a different reason. I'd like to show you a little bit of what I saw when I looked at where the war began in Israel to show you why it startled me the way that it did. I love your technology here almost as much as I love you, all the screens and the electronic things. This is a picture of Al-Umim Kibbutz. It's one of the kibbutzim that was attacked by the Hamas terrorists on what we call the last great day, or the eighth day of the Feast of Tabernacles last year. It was the home of 70 settlers, men, women, and children. They were brutally attacked by Hamas there. You have read and heard about that a great deal. This is a street corner in Al-Umim. Very pleasant place. Looks like any place in our country. Might even look like your neighborhood, except for the Hebrew street signs. These are some sample homes, and you can see the nice parkland around them. Again, nicely groomed, nicely landscaped, very attractive buildings. It looks like any suburb in the Western world. This is a backyard in Al-Umim before the attack, and there are children's play sets there. This is a parking lot at Al-Umim, and notice the cars that are there. You see the Western sedans? There's some small SUVs and some small sedans, all modern-looking, all in good shape. And again, it looks like any place that you might see in the Western world. That photograph is actually from a closed-circuit television capture of the parking lot on the day that the terrorists attacked. It doesn't show anyone being shot. It doesn't show any bullet holes in the cars. I didn't want to do that. But it does sort of bring home all of these things that happen. All of these photographs resemble places where we live. And that was very startling to me. The reason I went to the Olivet Prophecy, as I say, was not to find out where does this fit into end-time prophecy, but I went there to get the answer to a question that the disciples did not ask. That may seem a little strange to you. In Matthew chapter 24, if you turn to the Olivet Prophecy, we'll read the two questions that the disciples did ask. Matthew 24 begins, Jesus went out and departed from the temple. Some commentaries say that that's when the presence of God left the temple, never to return again until the coming millennium. His disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And that's a little bit odd because they're all about the same age. Christ had been in the temple. We know from the Bible, from the time that he'd been a young child, he obviously knew the temple. So why did they say, oh, Jesus, look at that? Well, we do that when we see something. We're traveling together or whatever, or walking together, and you see something beautiful or outstanding. You say, oh, look at that. And I guess that is the context of them saying that. But Jesus said something unusual. He said, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left there upon another that shall not be thrown down." The two questions then that were triggered by the disciples are recorded in the next verse. After he left the temple area and they settled on the Mount of Olives and they had some private time, the disciples came to him and they said, "Tell us, when will these things be?" It's usually why one goes to the Olivet Prophecy. When is the end going to come? And secondly, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? How will we know when this is about to happen? Obviously, the thought is to be prepared for it, to not be caught off guard by it. Jesus gave a lengthy answer to these questions, and he did not answer them, at least in a way that you could take the answer and then plot out on a calendar and say, okay, here is the timing for when Christ will return. Nor can you take world events and plot out world events and say, okay, when these things happen in this sequence, that is when Christ is going to return. In fact, anytime you heard these words or read these words over the last 2,000 or so years since Christ spoke them, you would draw the conclusion that the end could be right now as we look at world events, as we look at the things that Christ said in the answer. It's a beautiful answer. It's wonderfully worded. It is not dated. It was said in a way that would leave anybody who heard it, anybody who read it, inspired, warned, stirred to action, and anticipating that the end could come at any time. Think if he had done it otherwise. Think if he had said, well, you know, the end is not coming for over 2 millennia. So, you know, don't get too stirred up. Don't get too excited or too passionate about the work of the church. No, that wouldn't work very well at all for anyone's life. He answered it in a wonderful way. But he did go on to answer something else. That's the third question. The question the disciples did not ask, but probably they should have. Let's go back to verse 1 again. Jesus went out from the temple. The disciples said, "Look at this." And he said, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left there upon another that shall not be thrown down." Why did he say that? This is not an end-time prophecy. In no way is this a sign of the end. The temple stones were thrown down, but not for about 40 years after Jesus spoke that. And the temple was destroyed, but then time went on and on and on. The disciples aged and eventually died. Some put to death, some died of old age. I guess maybe John was the only one who died of old age, but the church has gone on. So why did Christ point these temple stones out and tell the disciples that they were going to be thrown down? Before we go deeper into that, I want to give you some more background about that kibbutz in southern Israel. I picked that one for good reason. It was established in 1966, 58 years ago. I won't ask for a show of hands of how many of you are under 58, but it may surprise you to learn that about 90% of the nation of Israel is under the age of 58. That means that kibbutz has been a fixture in the nation of Israel for the lifetime of a vast majority of the people who live there. It was a fixture, and obviously it was a fixture. It was home for the 70 residents. It was a safe place for them. Not only is it a beautiful place, they were fortified. Many of the citizens had weaponry. Many of the citizens, if not all of the homes, had safe rooms into which they fled. It was startling to think that that place could be overrun in a matter of minutes, and all the horrors could take place that did take place. I want to bring up another thing from current events that happened not too long ago. This is the Francis Scott Key Bridge in the Baltimore Bay area. This is before that accident happened. There is the transport ship as large as the Statue of Liberty laying on its side. That's how big that vessel is. And, of course, if you saw the video, as I did, of the accident, that bridge came down in about 4 seconds. And it had been there for 47 years. 35,000 people a day drove across that bridge. It was a fixture for the people who live there. Any of you ever driven over that bridge? Okay, at least one of you have. I think my wife and I did. We have children and grandchildren who live in that area, and we have visited in that area. Certainly it was a fixture for all of those people. I think it'll take about 4 years for it to be rebuilt. To have it destroyed in a matter of seconds was just inconceivable. Why do I mention these two events in conjunction with the Olivet prophecy? Remember this exchange between Christ and the disciples and those who were accusing him from John chapter 2? Jesus said, if you destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up again. And of course, he was referring to his body coming back to life after 3 days. Notice what the Jews said. It has taken how long to build the temple? 46 years. Not quite as long as the Al-Yamim Kibbutz was in place, but about as long as the Francis Scott Key Bridge was in place. It was a fixture in the lives of the disciples. Probably the temple had been there longer than any of the disciples had been alive. We estimate that they were probably in their 30s. And certainly it was a fixture for Christ's life. It was so much a part of their life that it was reality. It was shocking to hear Christ say, you see these stones? There's not going to be one stone of this building left on top of another. They're all going to come down. Look at this model of the temple from the first century. This is an AI-generated model, but it does show the scale. You see the size of the temple building, the temple stones, in comparison to the city homes around. The little, I don't know if you can see them from where you are, but the little tiny creatures at the bottom are people. They look like ants crawling around there. And that would be the perspective that the disciples had as they're looking at these stones when Jesus said, not a single one is going to be left along atop another. Here's another picture of first century Jerusalem and a model of the temple. This is a scale model that you can actually see in Jerusalem. I've circled the temple so you again can get the perspective that the disciples had as they were in the temple, coming out of it, looking down on Jerusalem, and you can see the size comparison between the temple and the city structures. And think of Christ's words echoing in your ears. Not one stone that you see will be left atop another. All of this massive structure will be destroyed. His words would have shocked the disciples immeasurably, even though what he said did not have anything to do with the end time that they were asking about. Why did he say it to them? Was it because it would shock them the way that it did? Turn with me back to Psalm 11. There's an article in the current Discern about Psalm 11, and it talks about this same concept that I'm going to discuss with you for a few minutes. Psalm 11 might be personal soul-searching from King David, or it might be from an accuser who is pointing out to David and accusing him, criticizing him for his reaction to something that was happening in his life. Psalm 11, beginning in verse 1, in the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, maybe someone else saying to him, or maybe talking to himself, how can I say this to myself? How can you say, flee as a bird to your mountain? You know, you're out hunting. You ever go hunting for birds? I've often hunted for quail. I think when God and the Father and Christ were creating quail, they put a shotgun up on the whiteboard next to the design of the quail. And the quail is well designed to defend itself, believe me, from a shotgun. They're very adept at getting away. When you startle a bird when you're out walking through the woods or something, it's gone. It goes to a safe place, high, far away, or both. And that's what David's reaction was, whether he's talking to himself or somebody else was pointing it out to him. Why do you have this sense of you've got to get away, that you've got to flee, that you've got to escape? For look, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. He was under assault, as happened many times in his lifetime. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Something was happening in his life at that time that threatened his reality, that threatened his sense of safety, that stirred in him a sense of, I got to get out of here. I need to escape what is going on. Let's look at a few other translations of this phrase at the end of the verse, or the end of chapter, or the end of verse 3. The English Standard Version, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Jesus was speaking of the foundations of the temple being destroyed. The Amplified Bible, if the foundations of a godly society are destroyed, not just a building, but an entire way of life. The way of life in Ukraine has changed completely. The way of life in Gaza has changed completely. And it has changed, really, this doesn't get a lot of publicity, but it's changed for tens of thousands of Israelis. People have had to evacuate northern Israel because of rockets coming in there from Hezbollah and haven't been able to be in their homes. Children have not been able to be in school. They're taking school classes remotely. And you know what that did for our children, American children, during the COVID years. It's not been an easy time. The Christian or the contemporary English version, what can an honest person do when everything crumbles, not just the society or a building, but everything in your life that was normal and real for you? The International Children's Bible, when all that is good falls apart, what can good people do? Whatever translation you look at, however you want to take it, whether it was David speaking to himself or somebody criticizing him, the point is the same. It's talking about an experience that shakes the godly person to his foundation. When that which was bedrock in your life no longer is safe, and you naturally want to escape. I want to read another Psalm, 48 this time, to show you how much a part of the thinking of the disciples the temple would be, and the city of Jerusalem, not just because it was a massive and impressive building. It was virtually a part of their theology. Psalm 48, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, in his holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth. Wasn't just meaningful for them, but Jerusalem for thousands of years had an impact on all nations around the Middle East. Is Mount Zion on the sides of the north a city of the great king? God is in her palaces. He is known as her refuge. For behold, the kings assembled. They passed by together. They saw it, and they so marveled. They were troubled, and they hastened away. Commentators say that this perhaps was a time when kings surrounded Jerusalem and were thinking of attacking it. But they saw the city itself, they saw its towers, and they were startled. Maybe there was an Elisha-like event, and God revealed to them that his power was with this city and protecting it. I don't know. Commentators don't know. They speculate. But something happened so that the kings withdrew. They were troubled. They hastened away. Fear took hold of them there, and pain, as of a woman in birth pangs. Dropping down to verse 12. Let's pick it up in verse 8 first. As we have heard, we have seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish it forever. Isn't that a promise that Jerusalem would always be there? Isn't it a promise that the temple would always be there? This particular psalm was written at a time when there was a temple in existence. Now, I suppose the disciples could have said, well, the temple has been destroyed before. In fact, Jerusalem has been destroyed before. But would you think that? Would you think in New York City when you see the replacement for the World Trade Center that, the World Trade Center came down once, it's been built back again. It wouldn't bother me if it came down again. No, it would be terribly shocking to have a mainstay structure taken down, and it would have been for the disciples as well. Verse 9, we have thought, O God, on your loving kindness in the midst of your temple. Verse 12, walk about Zion and go about her, go all about her, count her towers, mark well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. So the disciples did hear that from their parents. Their parents heard it from their grandparents, and so on it went, all the way back to the generations from the time that Jerusalem was first established as God's city under King David. So for Christ to say that the foundations of Jerusalem would be torn down was a great shock for the disciples. As I was preparing a sermon, I thought through times in my life when my foundations have been shaken. This happens in everybody's life. It hasn't happened to you yet. It will. I assure you, because it's just part of life. Was it a warning? Was what Christ said to the disciples a warning for all of us? I think that's part of the reason why he said what he said. In 1971, I was in Ambassador College in Pasadena, and the foundations of the earth did shake. That was when the San Fernando earthquake, San Fernando Valley earthquake, occurred. I think about 80 to 90 people were killed in San Fernando as a result of that. The building that I was in, one of the campus dormitories, shook and rocked. All of the chimneys collapsed. I was still in bed. It was 6 in the morning. The bunk beds in the room rocked back and then hammered together, rocked back and hammered together, rocked back and hammered together for a full 60-plus seconds. Might not seem like a very long time for the earth to shake, but the earth is supposed to be where you go when things are insecure. We say terra firma, but terra was not firma. Terra was terrible. I had a friend who was outside walking, and he said that the earth was going just like you take the end of a rope and whip it, and you see the waves go down the rope. He said the earth was going like that. It was just moving up and down. There was no place to go, no place to stand, no place to escape to that was safe. It addled the mind, as it were. I remember the students and faculty, people who worked there, wandered around the campus for about 2 days. People felt insecure about going back to their regular rooms to sleep because nobody knew if there were going to be aftershocks. I've had very serious experiences with 3 of my 5 children. 2 of my sons nearly died at different times. One nearly a year old, he had an incarcerated hernia. And we weren't aware at all of this birth defect, but there was an opening in the abdominal wall, and part of the large intestine slipped down into that and was choked off, and he had emergency surgery, without which he would have died. And some years later, my second son had had whooping cough, and he was over it entirely, we thought, but he had a relapse. He was being looked after by a lady in the church who actually was a retired RN. He was in good hands. Receiving good care, but he aspirated and choked. He turned blue, had to get the ambulance, rush into the hospital. The lady's husband came, the babysitter's husband came to get me, and as I got into his car to be taken to the hospital, he said, "Don't get your hopes up." It was a pretty traumatic situation. Some years later, my daughter at age 19 suffered a traumatic brain injury. She was doing some counselor work at a Youth Opportunities United, we called it at the time, YOU, in Worldwide Church of God days, in California on the beach. She was out in the water with one of the teens, and a wave picked up this teen and hammered into my daughter hammered their heads together, knocked my daughter out for 45 minutes. There was an older adult there who was supervising but did not think in terms of calling for paramedics or help, and my daughter was oxygen-deprived for that time. And she suffered hypoxia. She suffered brain damage. She had neurological issues off and on for years, finally to collapse a few years later, ended up being hospitalized, unable to walk, and eventually she was put in a rehab hospital. And I can remember as a Polaroid moment, you know how these things happen and your mind photographs something and you can call it up for the rest of your life. I'm standing in this nursing facility with the odors that are common in a nursing facility, and here's my 25-year-old daughter in a bed there, and the doctor telling me, "Your daughter will never live anywhere except in a facility like this for the rest of her life." That did not happen. Thanks God, he intervened, and eventually she recovered, and she's doing quite well now, thank you. But that was a time when my foundations collapsed. I was retired from pastoring in the Worldwide Church of God in 1994 after many years of up and down issues with my personal health. And finally, the administration decided that I could no longer continue as a pastor and longer function in that way. So I was left with 5 dependent children at the time, and I was looking for a way to reinvent myself, as it were, and do something to support myself. The church was generous in lending support, but I was not one to just sit and deal with that. A few months after that, only a few months after I was retired, the Worldwide Church of God collapsed theologically. It's like Jerusalem or the temple collapsing in terms of relating to our lives. Many of you went through the same things. I grew up in a Protestant church. When God called me and opened my mind and I saw the truth, I went, wow, that's it. And man, I'm never going back. I tried to explain to all of my family how wrong they had been. They did not take it real well for some reason. Didn't help my relationship with them. But then after many years in the Worldwide Church of God, and I had been a pastor for nearly 20 years at the time, the Worldwide Church of God became the Baptist church from which I came. And it just shocked me to no end, as it did many of you. A few months after the Worldwide Church of God collapsed, my wife divorced me. So we go from retirement to the church collapsing to my family collapsing. And my foundations were crumbled. So when I say it happens, it can happen to you, it happens to just about everybody, I think. Hence, we come to the third question. What should I do when my foundations crumble? That's what they didn't ask. The foundations will crumble, Christ told them. And they should have said, all right, Jesus, what are we going to do when that happens? Not, when are we going to get out of here? When are you going to come and save us? Whether it's truly the beginning of the end of the age, or whether it's a personal crisis when your foundation crumbles, what do you do? What do you do, in the words of the International Children's Bible, when all that is good falls apart? What can good people do? Christ actually answered this question in detail in the Olivet Prophecy. And that's why I went to the prophecy. I asked myself, okay, we know things are going to happen in a certain, in general, we know the outline of end time events. So what do we do? What should I do as a result of the Israel-Gaza war, as if they're two countries? It's an internal war in Israel. What should we do as a consequence of that, as a consequence of the European war? Christ answered this in great detail in the Olivet Prophecy, and that's what I'd like to look at for the remainder of the time here today. You might put the statements in different ways. I'm sure we would all phrase them differently, but I have codified it, as it were, in 12 different statements that Christ made. Go back to Matthew chapter 24. I'm tempted to say something funny about Mr. Flynn, who enjoys turning the lights on and off and having his part in the slideshow, but I won't say a thing about it. Matthew chapter 24, verses 3 and 5. The disciples said, when will these things be, the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus said, I'll tell you what's going to happen and how you're going to know. No, he started out by saying, see that no one leads you astray. Well, I would think when your foundations crumble, that's the last time you'd be led astray. The New King James says, take heed that no one deceives you. Wouldn't you be more zealous, passionate for the truth when your foundations crumble? Mark chapter 13, the parallel chapter, says, be on your guard, for many will come in my name, Christ said, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. Be on guard, don't be led astray or deceived. That's the first point of the first statement from Christ. When your foundations crumble, he warns us, you are likely to be weakened physically, mentally, and spiritually. It might leave you discouraged, it might leave you depressed, it might leave you frustrated, but it will leave you especially vulnerable to being deceived. Now, as we look back in our recent church history, quite a few people were deceived when the foundations of the church crumbled. And it has happened when homes have crumbled with divorce and other problems in a home. Some people have turned away from marriage and family altogether when those things happen. Some people have given up the faith altogether. Of course, many churches of God began for different reasons when the church came apart. Some of them began for the wrong reasons. Some people began to look for a following. I was going to comment more on that. I'll stay away from that. But some people just gave up and quit. I heard one minister say one time, you know, there is such a thing as spiritual roadkill. Christians were kind of run over by the church vehicles as they began to go in different directions. And, you know, that's implying that they were innocent victims entirely. But we all have choices to make. At any rate, a lot of people were deceived, as Christ said would happen when the foundations are crumbled. Number two, from Matthew 24, verses 6 through 8, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, see that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. Now, the disciples wanted him to say, when is the end? But he said, wars and rumors of wars, but not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pangs, not the end of the age, just the beginning. One translation, the voice says, do not panic. Mark 13 says, do not be anxious. Luke 21 says, do not be terrified. So do not be alarmed or anxious when your foundations crumble is the next point. I think this is perhaps one of the most difficult things that Christ ever said that we should do. When the ground shakes and you can't find any place to go where it's safe, don't be anxious. You know, Hezbollah just launched a new type of weaponry into northern Israel. They now have a drone that fires two hypersonic missiles, and they killed several IDF soldiers with them. But don't be alarmed when the hypersonic missiles come into your home. Just don't worry about that. Now, I don't mean to make light of it, but I actually mean to emphasize that this is a difficult instruction to follow. Your safest place is going to crumble, but don't be upset. There is a way not to be upset, which is the main lesson we want to take from this instruction Christ gave, but this is the point that I want to pick up on for number two. Number three. Here we bring in Luke chapter 21, the parallel chapter, verses 12 and 13. But before all this, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. That's a very unsavory thought. And you will be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake. This will be your opportunity to bear witness. Therefore, settle it therefore in your minds, not to meditate beforehand how to answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict. I don't take this as a prohibition against thinking ahead. I believe we're supposed to think ahead and try to do what we can to care for ourselves and care for our loved ones. But I take it as a caution that we will not be able to script our lives. You ever listen to newlyweds say, when we have children? Well, you have heard that. You said that, didn't you? And then you had the children. God gave me five children that are completely different from each other. So I would not be tempted to say, well, this is how you bring up children. One of them, and I won't mention which one it is, I never figured out how to, you know, there's some way you deal with this. Some are kinesthetic learners, and some are abstract, and some are just strange. This one was strange. He grew up and went away and came back home and just got old and had children that were just like him. Which is a good thing. You cannot script your life. You cannot say, this is what I would do if I was persecuted. This is what I would do if the church had such and such a challenge or difficulty. This is what I would do if the United States went this way economically, et cetera, et cetera. You cannot script everything out and have everything fully controlled. Here's the caution. There will be times in your life when things are so completely crumbling that you will be caught off guard. You must depend totally upon God to see you through. And there is a promise within what Christ said. God will see you through. He said it in the sense of he will give you the words to say that you need to say, and then you'll be able to see yourself through the particular, in this case, a court situation where you're tried and brought before a judge. There are other things that happen that rattle you so. Do take precautions, do think ahead, do picture yourself saying the things you should and doing the things you should, but be aware that things will happen that take you completely off guard, and at those times you have to depend upon God. Number four, Matthew 24, back here now, verses 10 through 13. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But one who endures to the end will be saved. One translation says, or paraphrases, when you endure right through it all. Does that mean you just suck it up, tough it up, and tense your muscles and just endure whatever suffering you're going through? No, it's talking about enduring and loving. Enduring and remaining in a family, in a church family. Let's look at some different translations as we talk about this. The Amplified Bible. The one who endures and bears up under suffering to the end will be saved. Bears up being a Christian and not having his love grow cold. The Complete Jewish Bible. Whoever holds out till the end will be delivered. Holds out against the pressure that comes on you when the foundation crumbles. The contemporary English version. But if you keep on being faithful right to the end, you will be saved. Stand firm right through it all when your foundations crumble. What happens when the foundations crumble? You're inclined to withdraw from other people. Ever feel that way? I just need to be by myself. That's good. Christ went off by himself at different times. But it's not good to completely withdraw into yourself. And some, again, in terms of local recent church history, have done that. They have withdrawn from the church altogether and withdrawn into themselves, sometimes literally themselves, sometimes with a small family group or a small group of friends. And Christ cautioned against that. You'll be inclined to be angry if you feel you have been betrayed. It's very easy to say, or it's very difficult to say, okay, you betrayed me, so okay, people do that. No, you don't want to see the person who betrayed you. You don't want to be around the person who betrayed you. And if you feel the church betrayed you, which some have felt, then they don't want to be around the church. They kind of recreate the church themselves, which some have done. It's tempting to become unloving when you are hurting. But don't withdraw from life, don't withdraw from other people, and don't withdraw from God's church when your foundations are challenged. Number five, Matthew 24, verse 14, very familiar scripture. This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout all the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. You could say, well, that's just a statement of fact. Well, I think it's more than that. The New King James says it will be preached. Mark 13 says it must be proclaimed. Who proclaims it? Well, from the time you began to be a part of the Church of God, or if you grew up in the faith, from the time you began to embrace it and take it to yourself and make a commitment for yourself, we all realize that we were called to the work. Some in their drifting, some in their reaction to the foundations crumbling in recent decades have said, the work is over. We just need to socialize, fellowship, just like local community churches do, only that part. Fellowship is good. A community support is a good thing. It's a good thing to have garage sales. But there is a work to do. Preach the gospel, preach the gospel, preach the gospel. There will never be a time until God allows the work to be stopped. Amos 8, verse 11 prophesies a famine of the hearing of the word. But until God declares it done, there is never a time for you or for me to say, oh, my life is a mess, the foundations have crumbled, I have lost faith and confidence in Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so because of something that was done or said. Therefore, no more work of God. No. There's always the work of God. And we're called to be a part of that, called to be doing it. Number six, verses 15 through 18. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. What's the abomination of desolation? Is it standing in the holy place? Well, there isn't any holy place right now where sacrifices are being offered. And as far as we understand the meaning of the abomination of desolation, it is not in place right now. There is something about this that will not be fulfilled until it is fulfilled. And then the reader will understand. But there is something here that we can apply. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. There will be a time to escape Judea. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. This addresses the fact that when a crisis strikes, we want to rush to salvage. Maybe the family pictures, maybe the money you have buried in the coffee can in the backyard. Hopefully the children and grandchildren are in there somewhere. One translation of the Bible says, do not go back down to get your pets. And I suppose that's very realistic in today's world. Many people would even endanger their lives to rescue their pets. But the point is, we want to save others and we want to save ourselves when there's a crisis. You want to control things when your life goes out of control. Surviving any crisis, though, including the crisis at the end of the age, as the book of Daniel uses that phrase, surviving any crisis is not in or subject to the preparation that we can do for secure reasons, like an emergency supply of food and water. You got that? You're good. You've got X number of dollars in gold? You're good. You have a bunch of weapons hidden somewhere? You're good. Hope you don't have that. You have a bomb shelter. You have a cabin fully stocked in Montana that is room enough for me and my wife to visit you. You're good. Now, you may have all of those things, but that's not your security. Security does not come, will not come, from you being able to seize control when it seems like everything is crumbling around you. Now, does that mean you should just let everything happen? I tried to get somewhere secure when the building was coming down. I knew that the work wasn't over, but I was not sure that God was through with me. There's a difference, you know. The work isn't done, but Cecil, he's, you know, that's a little different. We don't really need him. Security comes from God. It relates back to one of the earlier points, but it is a separate point here that Christ made. You will not be able to seize control and make everything okay. Number 7. Pray that your flight not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. Did Christ know that people were going to be in different time zones? I'm being facetious. You better hope that when you pray that your flight will not be on the Sabbath, that the brethren in New Zealand aren't ahead of you. They may pray that the flight would not be on the Sabbath, so it skips the Sabbath, but then comes to us on the Sabbath, or vice versa. Or we pray that the flight would not come in the winter, but our prayer is answered, but the brethren in south of the equator, they're in the winter. I don't take what Christ said to mean that. I mean, I take it to mean we should pray that God would see us through and not allow a crisis to just completely overtake us. And there are promises in the scripture that state it just that way. 1 Corinthians 10:13, I'm reminded of, no trial has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and you will be able to deal with that. But we should include this in our prayers, and I have been more since I looked at this instruction from the Olivet Prophecy again. Pray that the crisis would not be impossible to deal with. We trust God that it would not be. We should not be, it's obvious when he says don't travel in the winter or the Sabbath. Both are inopportune, difficult. We shouldn't do travel on the Sabbath unless it is absolutely necessary and, coming, going to and from the feast, etc. We should pray this about crises in advance. And on that point, all of these instructions are to be practiced in advance. These are not instructions for when the world comes to an end, break glass. Begin to do number 1, number 2, number 3. No. These are things we should think about, know about, pray about, put in practice in our lives and put in practice when those crises come in our lives and our foundations crumble here and there. We should be doing this all along. Number 8. Matthew 24, verses 23 through 28. If anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. Now, this would not affect us, would it, in the church? We're not going to say, well, you know, Christ is downtown this afternoon. Forget men's club. You know, go down there and meet Jesus Christ. You're not going to be taken in by that. But he said this to the disciples. Why did he say that? What would it mean to us? For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Christ did not minimize this problem, this challenge. He did not brush it aside and say, oh, well, you guys have all been called into the church. No problem with you. He warned them not to believe it if someone says, here is Christ. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Where the corpse is, there the vultures will be gathered together, or will gather together. That's a bold analogy, isn't it? The first funeral I did, I was a new pastor, and the janitor where we were renting the church hall came in, and he spoke to the deacon, gave him a message. I didn't get this until after church services. The deacon said, got a message, wants you to call such a number. So I did, and it was a funeral home. And the family of a co-worker in the Worldwide Church of God at the time was calling to see if I would conduct the funeral for this co-worker who had died. The only church he had was his association, loose association with Worldwide. He had a lot of literature from the church. And so I went over to the funeral home and met the family, and I asked the funeral director where we would do the funeral. I did not have the funeral outline, the ministerial guide. I had been to one church funeral, I think. So, I mean, talk about winging it. So he said, come on, I'll show you where it is. There's a body in there. Of course, that won't bother you. I said, no. No, that won't bother me. Thankfully, the casket was closed, and I did not look upon the body. But it does make the point, doesn't it? Where the corpse is, there the vultures will be gathered together. When you are in a crisis, Christ is warning, it is tempting to reach out to something or someone as security. David's psalm put it, flee to your mountain. We are church-oriented. We are God-oriented. It is tempting to reach out to someone who explains God, to someone who seems godly, to someone who says, I know what's happening, or someone who says, oh, I knew something was off for a long time. So you go, oh, wow, yeah, oh, I missed that. I'll go follow you. You are vulnerable to being taken in to go to some other body than the body of Christ in a time of crisis. Mr. Armstrong used to say, hang on to the trunk of the tree. We lived through a time when Worldwide broke up, when the trees all began to move. And it was hard to hang on to the trunk of the tree. But really, the trunk of the tree is the Father, is Jesus Christ, is their truth. And God did cause people, did inspire people and help people to hang on to the trunk of the tree so we could stay with the body of Christ and not go somewhere else. Some were taken away, some were discouraged, some drifted for a while and then came back. And, of course, the body of Christ is present in different organizations. I don't want to imply or state outright that the body of Christ is only here in Cogwa. We do not believe that. We recognize that God's Spirit is active in many different people. I do look forward to the time when everybody will be together. I am not prophesying or forecasting that that'll happen before Christ's return. I wish it would. I used to think at one time that I couldn't see the resurrection coming and somebody saying, well, who are you? Well, I was a member of the Church of God in the 2020s. Well, you were? I was too. Well, what church were you at? I didn't know. And so on it goes. But time has gone on and people who were in the Church of God have died. And they will come up, and people have come into different churches of God and have died in the faith, and they will come up in the resurrection, and we will meet each other and get into our background. But that's fine. We do want to make sure, though, and we want to have in our minds where the trunk of the tree is, where Christ is. We are not in the church just to put in our time or just to socialize or just because our family is in the church. Hopefully every individual is in the church to be with the body of Christ. Number 9, Matthew 24, verses 32 and 33. From the fig tree learn this lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. We've seen that very recently in our area as the trees have budded and put out their leaves. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. So even though Christ did not give us things by which we could plot on a calendar when he would return, even things by which we could plot world events and say, okay, now it's all coming together, that information is contained in the general outline in the Olivet Prophecy, so that when he does come, or leading up to just before when he comes, we will indeed be able to recognize the buds are on the tree. It will make sense, like working a jigsaw puzzle, and finally you see where the puzzle pieces come together and the picture begins to take place. That information is in the Olivet Prophecy. It is important to watch world events. It is important to look at the war in Israel and look at the war in Ukraine, to look at the change of government in the Netherlands and to ask yourself, what does this mean? Where is this going? Because that overall framework is within the Olivet Prophecy. Number 10, Matthew 24, verses 42 to 43. He said, therefore, stay awake, for you do not know what day your Lord is coming. Even though it's very plain in the Bible, many people say, well, I know he said you don't know the day, but I know the hour, I know the month, I know the year. Oh, come on now. You're just kidding yourself. You don't know the day, the month, or the year, however you want to different phrase it. Nobody knows. But know this, if the master of the house had known what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. So what does a person do if you know a thief is coming, but you don't know when? Well, you put a camera up, or you put an alarm system up, or you have guards who stay up all the time. You can't stay up forever, but you do watch. If you know a thief is coming, but you don't know when. You know, God has no ego. He didn't mind his church being compared to a corpse. Where the corpse is, that's where the vultures are. He doesn't mind being compared to a thief. I'm coming at a certain time. I promise you I'm coming. Just think in terms of a thief coming to your house. No ego there. He just used that as an illustration. Mark 13, the parallel. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. And that's a different analogy. This is not a thief breaking in, but the master returning home and the servants being prepared, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you all, stay awake. What I say to you all, stay awake. That's the point. Number 10, stay awake. And why would he say that? You know what the human reaction is when your foundations crumble? You want to go to sleep. You want to just pull in and drift and doze off and just, you know, wish it was already tomorrow or it was yesterday and that didn't happen. You want to go asleep. It's tempting to withdraw from life after a terrible shock. It's a natural coping mechanism. You seek comfort in isolation. And Christ said, no, don't do that. Stay awake. Be a part of things. Be alert. Be committed. Be counted on. Number 11, Matthew 24:44. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. Other translations say, be prepared. So whatever way you want to put that, be prepared or be ready. I separated this from knowing the signs and staying awake because there are many people who know the signs. Mr. Pierce was mentioning a friend or an acquaintance in the sermonette, somebody who knew the signs, knows the scriptures well. There are people who follow a string of websites that watch prophetic events. And they know the things that are coming in conjunction with Bible prophecies. When I say there are people who are following that, I mean people who are not necessarily a part of the Church of God. There are people who watch world events. They watch the weather. They watch warfare. They can tick off the details of what's happening and right along with the outline that Christ gave in the Olivet Prophecy. But there's a big difference between that and being spiritually prepared, personally, individually. You can know what's going on in the world and not be prepared for the kingdom. Your spouse can be prepared for the kingdom, and you not. Your parents, and you not. Your children, and you not. Most of everybody in the congregation, and you not. And so on it goes. You get the point. Be prepared. Christ causes us, inspires us to look at ourselves individually. Where do I stand spiritually? And nothing causes us to do that more than when the foundations crumble. Number 12, verses 45 and 46 of Matthew 24. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food in the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing. Whom will Christ welcome into the kingdom and the Father welcome into the kingdom and say, here's your responsibility, welcome to the family? Complete Jewish Bible says it will go well with that servant if he is found doing his job when the master comes. So the point is, be fulfilling your responsibility. Mr. Armstrong used to emphasize repeatedly, you were not called, I was not called, for personal salvation. We will be saved, that is part of the calling, but we were called for the sake of what we contribute, for the sake of what God would have us do. I want you to think about 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 18. In the voice translation, it's similar in all translations that I read, but this one brings it out very well. This is where God comes in. God has meticulously put his body together. He placed each part in the exact place to perform the exact function he wanted. Why are you where you are? Why am I where I am? Because Christ wants us to fulfill a certain function. Not too long ago, I was asked if I was going to give the last sermon I ever gave, what would the message be? To which I said, do you know something I don't know? No, I thought about it, and I said, well, I don't know that I have anything in mind. And after thinking about it and praying about it, I thought, well, I would say so doing. That's a message that I would give. It's one of the last messages that Christ gave. I'd like you to think about this as you consider this point. So doing changes. I mean, the responsibility that you fill changes. Think of a new mother. We should pray every day. We encourage people to pray half an hour. We find that's necessary. New mothers find that they live in 5-minute increments. The baby is hungry. The baby needs changing. The baby is sleeping. The baby is awake, et cetera, et cetera. It's very challenging. Many a new mother, comes to Sabbath services and spends it in the mother's room because the child is so demanding. It just, life's circumstances cause your responsibilities to change. Is a mother doing something wrong if she's not praying for a full half hour at a time? No, she's fulfilling her responsibility as a young mother. Life changes at different stages of your age, of your health, of your family status, single versus married, married with children, new children. They're all new when they start, aren't they? Why do we say, you have a new baby? You ever woke up to somebody and say, ooh, you got an old baby? No, we don't do that. They're pretty wrinkled when they start. We won't go there. Life changes. Your responsibilities change when you have maturing children, when they are preteens, when they are teens. My dad said to me one time, why he said this, I haven't the faintest idea. He said, Cecil, I used to worry about you kids when you were growing up, and then you grew up, and now I really worry. Could be because he remained Baptist when I became a part of the church. I don't know. But responsibilities do change when your children grow and they marry and you have grandchildren and then great-grandchildren. My responsibilities have changed over the years. I was called into the church when I was a teenager. And then I was given the opportunity to attend Ambassador College after attending a couple different colleges for a while. Then I was given an opportunity to work on staff at headquarters. And then in the field ministry, And then, as I mentioned earlier, my health came crashing down, and I was not able to continue in that way. And then I was volunteering my time for a while, and then eventually came back to work for the church as a remote employee, hopefully not affecting my personality. I'm kidding. I don't want to be thought of as a remote individual. And then after working for the church as, you know, in editorial and writing for about 26 years, then I've had to retire again because of my health. My responsibility has changed, but having responsibility has not changed. There is responsibility. It's not always clear. Frankly, different times I have prayed, God, what would you have me to do? And sometimes, as you know, with health challenges and with aging, sometimes your contribution, your responsibility is prayer. I won't say only prayer, because the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, doesn't it? And perhaps much more than somebody who's preaching, writing articles, or whatever one individual might be doing. The point is, God has put us in the body where he wants us, and that does change. What doesn't change is that we never reach the place at which we can say, I'm done. I'm finished. My work is over. God is the one who makes that call. Blessed is the man whom God finds, whom Christ finds, so doing. And so that is the third question. What should I do when my foundations crumble? We've seen a running theme throughout the Olivet prophecy. Our physical safe places will be shaken at times, as the disciples found in their lives. And there is coming a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-history time, a crisis at the end of the close, or the end of the age, when the entire world, everyone's foundation, every part of society, every economy, every religion will be shaken to the core. There are specific things that we can do and should be doing to prepare for that and to survive those crises. I want to finish in one more psalm, number 46 this time. There are a lot of places that you could go to get this information. It just reiterates promises that we are familiar with, but it's very helpful to hear this as we rehearse what Christ said. I don't want this sermon, I don't want to leave the sermon with you as a point of discouragement. You might take it that way. We live in challenging times. We can isolate ourselves from those times, and I think many people do. I don't necessarily mean to imply that you do that, but many people ignore what is happening in the world as long as their little world is going okay. They're working, they're eating, they're sleeping, etc. Their family's doing relatively okay. So don't bother me with information about what else is going on. It's possible to slip into that, and I don't think that any of us is doing that. We do live in difficult times, but the good news is those times will pass. The good news is Christ gave this instruction so that we could and we would survive times when the foundations crumble. Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The stones did come down. Jerusalem was conquered. The people who lived there were scattered. The disciples did eventually die. The church has been rocked and socked with challenges through the ages. But God is still with it. God is with Jerusalem, but spiritual Jerusalem. He is with the temple, but the spiritual temple. He never promised that the physical temple would always stand, even though you have the word forever in Psalm 48 that we read earlier. Forever means so long as the circumstances in which this is expressed or stated continue. And the circumstances changed. The physical changes. The spiritual does not. And that's what Christ wanted us to know. Even though the earth be removed, and sometimes the earth does move, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, and there are landslides that will cause and have caused tidal waves, though the waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of our God, the spiritual city, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. Church organizations have floundered, but the true church has not. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just as at the break of day. The nations raged. The kingdoms were moved. There have been wars, and there will be more. He uttered his voice, and the earth melted. There is a God whose voice and whose authority and whose power can say, stop. And there'll be no more hypersonic missiles shot into schoolhouses. There'll be no more women raped, no more children slaughtered. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He stops the war machines from being able to function. He burns the chariots in the fire. Be still. It's very difficult instruction, again, to follow when things around you are moving. But we have an edge with the Spirit of God, with this instruction, with this counsel from Christ. We can be still and remember that God is God. Know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. And the God of Jacob is our safe place, our mountain, our escape, our refuge, always.